Welcome and thank you for attending 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium Session 354, titled Author Meets Critics, The Whites Want Everything, Indian-Mormon Relations, 1847 to 1877. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. Please type your questions into the Whova app to be addressed during the question and answer session. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There is more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. Andrew Hamilton is coordinating the panel for us today, and he will do the introductions.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Today's session is an author meets critic session on the book, The Whites Want Everything, Indian-Mormon Relations, 1847 to 1877. This book by Will Bagley is the last book in his Kingdom of the West series of books, which started back in the mid-90s with the release of The Pioneer Camp of the Saints, the 1846 to 1847 Mormon Trail Journal of Thomas Bullock. This is a 16-volume, as I said, set of documents related to the Mormons settling in the West and establishing their kingdom. And it's a fantastic series that Will has overseen and is very vital and important to our understanding of just what went on as the Mormons colonialized the Western United States. And I would encourage everybody to check this series out. This latest book is The Whites Want Everything. And in this book, Will has collected documents related to the just exactly what happened as the Mormons went in and started taking over these areas that the Native Americans had lived in for thousands of years. Not too long ago, I was looking up Brigham Young, and when I did, I found on somebody's website this picture with the graphic you see at the bottom. Brigham Young was friendly, kind, and helpful to the Lamanites. And the Lamanites, the American Indians, were friendly and kind in return. And Will's book, and here's a picture of Will for us, goes in and he basically debunks that myth, and it goes into great detail. And that is what our panel is here to do for you today. So let me tell you a little bit about the panel and then get to what's going on, because you're here to hear from them, not me. Will Bagley is an independent historian and the author, editor, or co-editor of nearly two dozen books on Western and Mormon history. Bagley has worked as a laborer, carpenter, cabinet maker, and country musician. You might not have known that last part. In 1979, he founded Groundhog Records to release his long-playing record, The Legend of Jesse James. He started his career as a historian in 1995. He is perhaps most famous for his book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, The Blood of the Prophets. However, I believe, if I remember right, he has said that his favorite series he has worked on is his Overland Trail series, which has two of four volumes currently out. My personal favorite Will Bagley book is River Fever, Adventures on the Mississippi, 1969 to 1972. In September 2014, the Utah State Historical Society granted Bagley its most prestigious honor as a fellow, joining the ranks of such luminaries as Dale Morgan, Wallace Stegner, Juanita Brooks, and Leonard Arrington. Darren Perry, if he makes it, he's not here yet. He is currently running for Congress, and hopefully he'll be here. But Darren Perry is the chairman of the Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation. He serves on the board of directors for the American West Heritage Center and the Utah State Museum Board. He teaches and lectures all over the country to all age groups. It is important to him that students hear and understand Native American history from the point of view of the American Indian. He recently this year released the first book to be released or written by a Native American on the Bear River Massacre, and it's called The Bear River Massacre, A Shoshone History. We are also joined today by Sarah Newcomb. And unfortunately, I don't have as much to say about Sarah, but she is an amazing and awesome person. And I am glad that she has become my friend and I have gotten to know her. She is a Native American, and she just told me how to pronounce this, and I'm going to mess it up anyway, but of the Tsimian of the First Nations. Her tribe resides in Metlakatla, Alaska, and is the only, which is the only reservation in that state. She was a seventh generation Mormon and now works as a freelance writer and editor who researches Mormon and Native American history and relations. She runs and writes the Lamanite Truth blog, and I would highly recommend that people go to her Lamanite Truth blog to learn more about various issues relating to Mormon and Native American relations. Dr. Elise Boxer, and I'm going to not mispronounce her name, hopefully, is an enrolled citizen of the Fort Peck. She also told me how to pronounce this. I'm going to skip one. I'll let her tell you how to say it later. And Sioux tribes. She is a Dakota from the Sisseton and Wahpeton bands. Boxer received her PhD in history from Arizona State University. Dr. Boxer has developed and taught, Dr. Boxer has developed and taught over 15 courses in Native American studies and history. She has taught a variety of courses in Native American studies, from the introduction to the Native American studies discipline to crime in Indian country. She is currently working on a manuscript that I can't wait to read called To Become White and Delightsome, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Construction of a Lamanite Identity. She also has a title or a chapter called This is the Place, Disrupting Mormon Settler Colonialism, in a book called Decolonializing Mormonism that I highly recommend to you. And she also has written many other articles, including The Lamanite Shall Blossom as the Rose, The Indian Student Placement Program, Mormon Whiteness and Indigenous Identity. All right, with that said, we will first hear from Will. We pre-recorded a segment with him in case he wasn't able to make it today. After that, if Darren is here, we'll hear from him, and then we will hear from Sarah and then Dr. Boxer.
Well, I'm here to talk about the work culmination of a lifetime's work, which is the Arthur H. Clarke series, Kingdom in the West. And this is the final volume, 16, The Whites Want Everything, Indian and Mormon Narratives, 1847 to 1877. And I had initially titled it Native Voices from the Mormon West, but as I began confronting the basic issues that the book addresses, the basic issue is race, and the insights I gained into my own perspectives and my own character flaws were profound. But let me just off the top give you a couple of my impressions of what these Native voices say. And they are honest and eloquent and compassionate. And the atrocities that they expose and the endemic racism, which was so deeply embedded in American culture, are a profound moral lesson. And I began to get insights into the different elements of Native culture in my home state of Utah. And I had to confront the fact that having been born in a nation that was officially racist and raised in a religion that was deeply racist and unapologetic about it, that I too was a racist. But I'll tell you, the respect that I earned for these courageous, noble people is a life lesson. And I've had been fortunate to have some of the world's best mentors. And I've also been both cursed and blessed by the restrictions imposed by LDS archives, because in the past, when I began work on this, 15 years ago, if you wanted to transcribe anything from the Brigham Young papers, for example, you had to go into the archives, bring up a microfilm, which was often not very legible, and then transcribe it onto your computer, which is always a fraught process. And I think I had a role in it, opening Mormon records to the Mormon people. And I also know that I wasn't nearly as powerful in that as my friend Rick Turley, who essentially liberated the Mormon people's records. And now you can download them. And they didn't really restrict very much. They attempt to hide excommunications, but they let out some of the most incriminating and damning documents about atrocities such as the Fort Utah fight in 1850. And they're very clear about the desire to appropriate, take over Indian land and move the Indians out of what is now the state of Utah. As Brigham Young said, hopefully someplace near the Sierra. But I was surprised at how difficult it was to wrestle with these issues day in and day out. And the pain that many of these documents evoke are tremendous. And whenever you start a book, you should have a thesis, and you should test that thesis against the evidence. And one of my longtime convictions was that Brigham Young was a bad, bad man, and that he treated the Indians despicably, which he did. But at the same time, despite the theological complications behind believing that native peoples were the battle axe of the Lord that would help you clear America of anyone that wasn't a believing Latter-day Saint, and was essentially using Indians as cannon fodder, that was inherently evil, which it is, it was. But at the same time, Brigham Young, who was always ensconced in a comfortable life in Salt Lake, tried to persuade the Mormon people not to kill off all the Lamanites, because they had a big, big role in his plans. And that council, and I quote a document by Levi Hancock, meant that it did something to mitigate what was typical of white expansion in the American West, which is whites came in, they killed or drove off the Indians, and they seized the land. And that is basically the same story that Latter-day Saints experience. But Brigham Young did try to mitigate those atrocities occasionally, except when he was ordering them. But it's one of those conclusions that, as I examined the evidence, I couldn't support. And I wound up concluding with Levi Hancock that although the Mormon people simply wanted to get rid of the Indians at any cost, Brigham Young's strange theological beliefs about the end of the world led him to try to mitigate what in other states like California was a straight up unmerciful genocide. And the genocide happened in Utah, but it wasn't entirely because of what Brigham Young was doing. I'm now completely gone in terms of lighting. Can you see that? Oh, now we're back. But the eloquence of these documents, you really have to hear them to appreciate it. And I will somewhat randomly pick up some of the choice quotes that will be found in White Swan. And I must address some of the book's limitations, which are, it focuses very much on the Utes. It has chapters on the Goshutes and the Southern Paiutes, and does deal with the Shoshone, especially in the context of the Utah War. But I give very short shrift to the Navajo, who ironically became big supporters of the Latter-day Saints, and there have been eloquent statements by Navajo of how they address the contradictions between their native heritage and the unsupported scientific claims of the origins of the Lamanites. But I will simply read a few statements. The most powerful is by a trader named M.S. Martinez. And he writes on July 6, 1853, "At the request of Major Holman, Indian agent for Utah Territory, I held a conversation with Indian Chief Wakara respecting his feelings and the wishes relative to the whites settling on his lands and on the lands of the Indians generally. He said he had always been opposed to the whites settling on Indian lands, particularly that portion which he claimed and on which his band resides, and on which they have resided since childhood, and his parents before him. Wakara grew up in what is today Spanish Fork. And that the Mormons, when they first commenced the settlement of Salt Lake Valley, was friendly and promised them many comforts and lasting friendship, that they continued friendly for a short time until they became strong in numbers. Then their conduct and treatment towards the Indians changed. They were not only treated unkindly, but many were much abused. And this course has been pursued up to the present. Sometimes they have been treated with much severity. They have been driven by this population from place to place. Settlements have been made on all their hunting grounds in the valleys, and the graves of their fathers have been torn up by the whites." He said he wished to keep the Valley of San Pete and desired to leave the Valley of Salt Lake, as he could not live in peace with the whites. But the whites had taken possession of that valley also, and the Indians were forced to leave their homes or submit to the constant abuse of the whites. And this is the sentence where Martinez attributes other leaders of the Utes to saying the whites want everything. And Martinez says that he had known Wakara and the other Ute leaders since they were children. And what I would give for 15 minutes of talking to Mr. Martinez. But I will read the concluding paragraph of The Whites Want Everything. And I talked to a friend of mine who is very, very close to the, wrote the best book on Utah Indians called Southern Paiute, A Portrait. His name is Logan Hedman. And I asked, how do you end a book about such a topic of despair? And he said, every time I would ask a Southern Paiute that question, they would talk about the land. And I believe that that is why Indians will ultimately outlast the people who so ruthlessly conquered them and exploited them, and will endure because Indians endure. Whatever scars energy exploitation and mining have inflicted on Indian lands, the land will endure and ultimately heal. Ironically, the poverty and hardship of reservation life has prepared Native peoples to be the ultimate survivors. Condors have returned to soar in Utah skies, and American Indians still speak truths about their past. As long as the Great Basin's first human inhabitants can commune with the land, tribal elders say, their people will have a faith and a future. If Americans understood history, they would not still be fighting, dying, and killing in Afghanistan. Let us learn a great lesson from the crimes of our collective past. There is only one race, the human race. As I said, this is the hardest book I have ever written. If I didn't say it in the earlier sentences, I will say it now. And it also comes, this event comes at the hardest time of my entire life. But I want to thank Sunstone for being so generous and helping us put together this panel. And Andrew, who really did the heavy lifting. And let's remember the counsel of all great spiritual leaders. Love one another. Thank you.
Will, since you're here, can you just take over? I'm sorry about that. I'm not sure why it's not sharing.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'll do my best. And cut me at 10 minutes, please.
Andrew, I'll leave that to you.
I'm a lot more interested in what the critics have to say than what I think of the book, because as I looked at it recently, it's hard to finish a work, a creative work, without seeing nothing but the mistakes. And as I've gone back through this book, I can see that it is full of highly useful materials. And I especially hope that my Native friends will find it useful. This is the most painful story I have ever told, and it was devastating to deal with it just about every day for 4 years. But I didn't have to live it, and living it, watching these arrogant and evil people who were my ancestors come into your land, destroy the natural environment, and try to displace your own personal religion and beliefs. But it's the story of human activity, and every colonization I'm familiar with, the technologically sophisticated society destroys the less sophisticated societies. And maybe that's a sign of what human nature is about. And as I dealt with these issues, I became more and more aware that by using these narratives, which all were filtered through Mormon ears, I was colonizing them again. And I don't want to do that, and I tried to avoid it, but that's for other people to judge. And I think I've said everything that I could say that's related to this event. And I do want to thank the organizers of Sunstone. And I wanted to comment that I sure miss the assembly of being able to rub shoulders with some of the people I like most in this earth. And I'd love to be able to meet the commentators here, person to person. But we will see what the future holds, and none of us know. Thank you.
All right, looks like Darren hasn't joined us, so Sarah, can you go ahead and go next, please?
Yeah. Amma Gaudi, Sugix, Datanis Nusa. Good afternoon to you all. Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Newcomb. I'm Tsimshian of the First Nations of the Eagle Clan. Like Andrew said earlier, my people are from Metlakatla. Before that, my main group, my main tribe is in British Columbia, Canada, by the Skeena River. I'm from a small group that broke off in 1887 and moved to Alaska and established a community called New Metlakatla. I felt really honored to be invited to read Will Bagley's book from his Kingdom in the West series, Volume 16, The Whites Want Everything. Naively, I had no idea what I was agreeing to. just like he said, Will, like how it's owned you for 4 years. I've been reading Native American history as long as I, you know, definitely by my teen years, I was really digging into it. And it is hard to read. It is emotionally exhausting. And I had no idea what I was getting into when I agreed to reading yours, but it's such an incredible wealth of information. Like, you didn't hold back. You just put it all out there. In college, I discovered this love for sourcing when I research. And if I can say anything about Will Bagley's book, it's an incredible compilation of sources. Granted, yes, they are all colonizer sources or white sources, Mormon sources, however you want to label it. But it's still this like unfiltered compilation of amazing sources from this one group. As someone highly empathetic, at times it was too much to read. So like it would just hurt. And it reminded me of experiences just like in my teens when I'd read Native American history that was not found in school books. Everything was heavily filtered at school, obviously. There's just like maybe a couple pages of Native Americans included. I'm not sure there was a single book in my teen years that I finished that I was able to find on Native American history because I would just be in tears. And Will's book was every bit as difficult, but it's so incredibly important. Reading history in my early life, like I said, I realized that history is often portrayed as being very different from what it really was. What I learned in school was a colonized narrative, and that's very similar to what I learned within Mormonism. Perhaps that's why history repeats itself. It's really hard to learn from history when history is manipulated or at the very least one-sided in its expression. So I'm really grateful though for Will Bagley's taking on this project. To start it off, in his acknowledgement section, at the very beginning of the book, Bagley quotes a novelist, Sherman Alexie, who wrote, "The concept of tribal sovereignty should logically extend to culture and religion. The real issue is that Indian relationships in this country is still that of the colonized, so that when non-Indians write about us, it's colonial literature. And unless it's seen that way, there's a problem." There's so much truth in that quote, and I respected Bagley so much for including it. After that quote, he goes on to write, "As a white, if not delightsome, native son of Utah, a name plate and a place named after a great basin people, I know Alexie's charge is true. I am guilty of culturally pilfering and presuming to speak for people not my own. Humans can justify anything and everything, be it mass murders or the theft of entire continents. So naturally, I excuse my attempts to recover Native voices from Anglo-American sources as an act of pious fraud. Perhaps if end justifies means, the book's purpose to provide access to forgotten voices that reveal the intelligence, resilience, and humanity of a brave and brilliant people who survived an inescapable and merciless trap vindicates my presumption." I gave a lot of thought to Will's thoughts here about that white narrative and how he was also part of that. And in response, I just want to say that you did an amazing job putting it all out there exactly as you found it. Your book is at the very least not going silent on history. And for that, I'm grateful, as silence and being silenced is a massively damaging and manipulative part of controlling narratives. You didn't hold back, manipulate, over-edit the information out. Instead, it's beautifully raw. And while it's that colonized view, you even take the time to address that. So I know a lot of white people that go, I've talked to a lot, three people have approached me specifically because it's intimidating going into Native American history as a white person. You want to share that love. You want to put it out there that there's different narratives, but you're also entering into a group that's been traumatized. So I know how difficult that it can be from that perspective. And I have, you know, compassion for that. But the way you begin it in this acknowledgement section is so extremely important, so that when Native or Indigenous people read your book, they take the time to read the acknowledgements, they'll understand exactly who you are and where your heart's at, because you've acknowledged even your part in the system. So I respected that. I was reminded of a quote by George Orwell. "Those who control the present control the past, and those who control the past control the future." That quote has stayed with me for years as I have fallen, and yes, completely fallen into researching history. I'm often left asking myself, who benefits from this version of history? Because history is all perspective, individual perspectives. You could get 20 people at the same event and come away with 20 different experiences. And then to have it recorded by different people, it's got to be acknowledged as being perspective also. As I read all the sources and stories that Will compiled, even then I acknowledged, just as Will did, that the narratives and sources were often one-sided from a colonizer's view. Often when people talk about wars with Native Americans, even in art, if we just take art for a minute, art with Native American wars and the American people is always depicted with like generals or these brave men with guns fighting Native Americans and warriors, but they're always full-grown adults. A lot of the art also depicts the men that are Native Americans as savage or half naked. And it's always this like image that we kind of have burned in our mind of what Native Americans were. Can you imagine art that depicts reality? Like art that depicts, and this is terrible because this is something that happened, art that depicts military beating Native American babies and children with rocks. in order to save bullets. Can you imagine art depicting the Mormon militia killing grandparents or parents? Or accurate art of the Mormon militia killing a 12-year-old boy as he runs away? Art of Mormons selling Native American children to other Mormon families in order to save them, quote, after they have been killed by Mormon militia, after their parents have been killed by Mormon militia. Is it any wonder that history is controlled? All people, regardless of ethnic background, we all have beautiful histories and also very harsh and hard histories. That's just human history. But still, George Orwell's quote once again rings true. Those in power often control the narrative. They control the past narrative to control the present and the future narrative. As I struggled to read The White Swan Everything, admittedly, due to my own emotional responses, which are ever present in Native American history, I had to take several breaks. Some breaks were days long, some were weeks. One day I picked up the book and I was just determined. I'm like, okay, I'm going to find something to talk about because it's so heartbreaking reading this and so important. I decided specifically to search for women because in indigenous cultures, many were matriarchal. We still had male leaders, but matriarchal to us meant that our societies were centered around women and women values with children at the very middle of everything. So I was like, you know, I'm going to take it from my Tsimshian views and try to find stories of all the women. Again, not realizing what I got myself into. One day I picked up the book and decided to search for women. Indigenous women were born into beautiful cultures that celebrated their wisdom and their life-giving heritage. And they inherently brought all that wisdom and generational wisdom to their tribes. Because women are at the center of indigenous families and cultures, I just kept thinking, this is important. This is where I want to focus. What was the women's experience during these years that nobody talks about? The ways their voices were erased, not only by white culture, but also by patriarchal culture. So I'm in the index, flipping through Will's book, and it's just, you know, I found some white women. It was really hard to find indigenous women because it's almost like we were invisible. I began highlighting every single female voice I could find in the index and referencing names that I wasn't sure if it was male or female and found a few. I'm going to read an excerpt from the book. Before I do, I just want to give everyone a small warning. Some of the parts are a bit descriptive and violent, so if you need to mute it, feel free. It's a small section. Just a bit. It's on page 342. About a girl named Sally. So Brigham Young told of an Indian in this territory by the name of Baptiste, a Ute slaver who had followed this business ever since I resided in this territory. So ever since Brigham Young had resided in that territory of trading for Indian children. And it says, in the fall of 1847, after we came here, he and Baptiste brought in our fort a young Indian boy and squaw that he had stolen in Beaver Valley from a tribe called the Pie Band. The boy was about 16 years old and the girl about 18, as near as we could judge. He offered them for sale. The people refused to buy them. Baptiste told the whites if they would not buy them, he should kill them. The whites, not believing his statement, still refused to purchase them. Baptiste then took out his two prisoners to his camp and killed the boy. Then he returned to the fort with the girl and offered her for sale. A young man by the name of Charles Decker, a son-in-law of mine, gave Baptiste a gun for the girl. She has lived with my family ever since, has fared as my children, and is as free. So that was Brigham Young. It goes on to say, legends swarmed around this child, including multiple origin stories. Eliza Snow claimed her Indian name was Kadash, but it was also Kapeputz. And Eliza Snow says, she was the saddest looking piece of humanity I've ever seen. She was the saddest looking piece of humanity I've ever seen. That was John R. Young, recalled 73 years later in his colorful but unreliable memoir. Wanship's band had lost two men in a fight and had taken two girls prisoner. This is where it gets a little bit more descriptive. They had killed one and were torturing the other. They had shingled her body with butcher knives and fire bands. All the fleshy parts of her leg, body, and arms had been hacked with knives, then with fire bands, and then stuck into the wounds. She was gaunt with hunger and smeared from head to foot with blood and ashes. Her brother gave the child to Clarissa Decker, Brigham Young's fourth wife, and she became known as Sal or Sally. Her tribal association lost, Eliza Snow recalled Sally was of the Pibandi tribe, whose cruel stepfather sold her into captivity, while Sousa Young Gates identified her as a Bannock prisoner. It goes on to say on the next page that Eliza Snow said that she shared mutual care and cultivation of Sally with Clarissa and recalled spending a wet night in Salt Lake's old fort, reflecting the ludicrous scene under a fully saturated flat dirt roof when the storm was much worse inside than out. Sally, being asleep on the floor altogether, made the situation rather romantic. At first, the captive crunched bones like a dog, but very soon became disgusted with her native habits, became neat and tasteful in dress and delicate in appetite. She proved to be a good, virtuous woman who died beloved by all who knew her. And then there's the next part, it mentions that Brigham Young's testimony in 1852 that says that she lived with his family just like his children and was as free. It talks about how she was listed in the 1860 census as female household help, and also records that Brigham Young told a visitor, "I have an Indian woman who assists in the housekeeping and is an excellent hand at the work. I obtained her when a child. At first she slept outside and preferred the meal she gathered from gutters instead of good fried beef, but she is ready to vomit now at the recollection of her former habits." Now all those stories about Sally were written from a non-Indigenous perspective. But, and that's some of what I really appreciated, that we'll just put it all out there. History is an interesting thing. And I love that there was various accounts recorded because it shows how unreliable history can be. Did the girl renamed Sally get taken by a Native American and sold to white people? Is the narrative told by Native Americans or by white people? Who benefits from controlling the narrative? As a comparison, in my own research, I did some work in the same time frame on the Tippecanoes. I found a girl by the name of Sekna who was sold to Mormons. One of her living descendants contacted me and shared with me some family journals, and I was able to compare them to Tippecanoe history that they have. And so I'm going to read just a small little bit from the journal. It's at the top, it says, "Sketch of Aunt Pernetti, Sketch of Aunt Pernetta or Nettie Murdoch by Millie Murdoch Witt. Grandfather," and this is Joseph S. Murdoch, "grandfather said he got the boy and girl from Porter Rockwell. Grandfather called him Traveling Port. He told Joseph S. Murdoch that the children had been stolen in one of the raids that the Indians would have, and that he bought the children to save their lives, and would Joseph S. Murdoch like to buy them from him?" Joseph S. Murdoch goes on to buy them in order to save them, but I've heard that narrative a couple times, that Mormons would buy Indigenous children to save them from being sold by Native Americans into slavery. And there's different stories, just like there was different information in Will Bagley's book. With the story that I researched, it came up with conflicting information. So in contrast, the Tippecanoes have this record. Sekna, with another male child, was taken by the Mormon militia when her people's Wakara camp was attacked. They were then sold by Orrin Porter Rockwell to a Mormon family by the name of Murdoch. The Tippecanoe account obviously has a different storyline. She wasn't sold by a bad Native American. Her parents were killed by the Mormon militia during the wars, and she was then sold to Mormons. Mary Meyer of the Tippinogas Nation related the following story of her great-great-grandfather, Joseph Stacy Murdoch. He was the first bishop of Heber City. Joseph raised two Tippinogas Indian children, one by the name of Pernetta, who he had taken from Fort Utah following the battle there. Pernetta was the daughter of Chief Arapian and was about 5 or 6 years of age when Joseph took her away with him to Heber and raised her to adulthood. At the same time, a Tippinogas boy at the same age lay clinging to the bloody remains of his mother. His name was Pick, short for Suppicus. He was taken and put in the wagon. So there's those two different versions of what happened to these children. And there's definitely benefits, I think, to controlling that narrative. I think it would be hard for a lot of Mormons at that time to see what was done to the people. And I can see that, you know, I have no doubt that some people genuinely were aching and wanting to help those indigenous children. Next, I'm going to share a little bit of Sekenup's life after she was purchased into the Murdoch family. Joseph S. Murdoch bought the children from Orrin Porter Rockwell and gave the children to his first wife, Eunice. Eunice gave Sekenup the name Pernetta, which had been Eunice's grandmother's name, and the boy was called Albert. In the Murdoch Family Journal, it states, the boy was just shedding his baby teeth, and the girl was about a year younger still. Eunice loved the children as her own. The Murdoch family actually conveys a lot of kindness and love for these children. So in some ways, they're lucky that they ended up in a situation where they were genuinely loved and embraced. It also states that during her childhood, Pernetta was taught to read and write by her mother, Eunice, right alongside with Pickett, Suppicus, and many of Joseph Stacy Murdoch's children by his other three wives. The journal records the following a little bit later on. Pernetta had grown into a beautiful young woman, well-educated and refined. A young Indian man became attracted to her, and both Eunice and Joseph were concerned that she might be lured away from both family and the church by him. On June 26th of 1859, Joseph Murdoch married his Native American adopted daughter, Pernetta, in the endowment house by Brigham Young. Pernetta was the first Lamanite to enter into the temple in this dispensation, according to the history seen and read by Luann Murdoch. When Pernetta married her adopted father, she became his fourth and youngest wife. Joseph S. Murdoch was about 37 years at the time, and Pernetta was 13, maybe 14. In a history by Amelia Murdoch-Witt, it states, many times the girl's heart was made to ache, but Joseph was just a man, and he tried so hard to see that she wasn't hurt bad, knowing too well what she was up against. Pernetta went on to have 5 children. When I compared this story of Pernetta to the story in Will Bagley's book of Sally, I was struck by a few commonalities, mainly with their origin stories, both being blamed on bad Native American men, selling children as slaves, and Mormons wanting to save them. It seemed like a common theme. Left out of history is the very actions being done by the Mormon militia themselves. This reminded me much like the Mountain Meadows Massacre, how it was blamed on Native Americans. I cannot say which narrative's true. Only history knows that, people that lived it. But I definitely share an appreciation with Will for reading the different versions and the different accounts, because the book, The Whites Want Everything, throws everything out there and isn't trying to control the narrative from the colonizer's point of view even. So it's definitely an important piece that's been added. Shadowing all of this, of course, is the Lamanite myth. Beliefs that Mormons had about indigenous people definitely had impacts. On page 41, it states, the term cousin Laman and cousin Lemuel reflected the belief that American Indians descended from Nephi's unrighteous brothers, who had hardened their hearts against the Lord God and did cause a skin of blackness to come upon them. I've covered this a lot on the work I've done, that the skin of blackness came upon them, but that the darkened skin is a sign of the curse. And it's important to focus on more on what that curse actually was. They turned away from God. So Native Americans are called Lamanites, and they're said to have turned away from God. That's why we weren't Christian or didn't fit in this box. But we turned away from God, and God cursed us by removing his spirit from us completely. That's a real level of evil, to remove his spirit from all indigenous people. That's how bad our ancestors were. Now, as a result of this curse, we lost protection of our promised land. And so land is such a huge theme in Native American history. And even, like, I've pointed this out to people a number of times, singing the song Book of Mormon Stories growing up as a kid, you know, all about my Lamanites in ancient history. Long ago, their fathers came from far across the sea, given the land if they lived righteously. In 1 Nephi, you can read about Lehi's close to death, and he's warning people, his sons, Laman and Lemuel, if you're not righteous, God's going to punish you by removing his spirit, and you're going to lose the land. And this is where we enter in a lot of Christopher Columbus teachings and land being taken because our ancestors weren't righteous. So this theme kind of coats over everything, that it just hangs there, but nobody really addresses it, that the Lamanites didn't have a right to their land anymore. And that theme in there was something I sang about as a child growing up. And even like the motion, you know, putting your fingers above your head to represent Native Americans' feathers was part of it. We can't change the stories or actions of our ancestors. Just as I am Tsimshian, I'm also seventh generation Mormon on my dad's side. So I had family that lived in Nauvoo and went west with everybody and claimed land that wasn't their own. History happened. What we do with history matters. There was a couple thoughts I had, and this is part of that land theme. It starts on page 482. Peter McGon to Brigham Young. And he's, again, this is going to get a bit descriptive, so if anybody's sensitive, this is where it gets a little heavy. And he relates the most sickening accounts and inhuman acts of the soldiers. I believe these are non-Mormon soldiers. They're people that the government sent in to help people, to help the Mormons, but I'm not 100% sure. But it says, the acts of the soldiers, and related to him by the squaws that still remained on the ground, after they had routed the Indians and killed the wounded by knocking them in the head with an axe, and then commenced to ravish the squaws, which was done to the very height of brutality. They affirm that some were used in the act of dying. The above reports are substantiated by others that were present at the time. We are unable to say what will be the future course of the Indians, as the men have left for the Bannock County country with the intention of a big council, and the squaws are afraid to come into our settlement lest the soldiers should come back again. We sent 60 men on Friday to bring our herd home, which all arrived safe and cached this evening without any interception from the Indians in that region. As near as we can find out, there were about 120 Indians killed and about 90 squaws and children. Several have counted them to about that number. I feel my skirts clear of their blood. They rejected the way of life and salvation, which have been pointed out to them from time to time, especially for the last 2 years, and thus have perished, relying in their own strength and wisdom. That stood out to me just because it really captured that belief that Lamanites, this Lamanite identity and Lamanite myth was placed upon people, and the only explanation for them not being Christian wasn't because there was this great variety of humans on the earth that all had beautiful and very unique beliefs, but because they turned away from God and were evil. At the very beginning of the book, I think it's in the introduction. There was only one part that I was like, well, wait a second. Sorry, let me flip to it. It states, its era and birthplace defined the Book of Mormon's romantic view of Native peoples. I just want to say that the romantic view is not romantic from a Native perspective. So it's just a romantic view from a colonizer's perspective. It's okay to hear conflicting stories and harsh realities. History is hard, but how do we heal and move forward? I personally love this moment of healing history that is no longer about silencing the past in an effort to maintain control of a dominant narrative at the cost of a specific hurt group. I love the compassion and unity expressed when people like Will Bagley make their attempt at telling the many sides of history, even when it is daunting to enter Native American history as a white person. History should not be feared. Silencing history should be. How we treat history leaves a rippling effect for generations. So I just personally want to send out a big thank you to Will Bagley for his work and courage and willingness to put his voice out there, even when he was unsure of himself. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Sarah. That was so good. Dr. Boxer, thank you, please.
Okay, so kind of there's some stuff that I was going to mention that Sarah already did. So just in terms of looking at time, I'll kind of like hint at them and maybe, but not as much detail. The way I kind of approached looking at this book was really looking at the end, what I liked at the end in the afterword. There's a couple different questions, right, that Will asks us, especially like as historians. And he says, I will leave it to the readers to answer the first of the questions that began this volume. Can such mediated documents reveal anything worth knowing about American Indians? Others require only short, obvious responses. How did the Mormon invasion affect the Great Basin's long tradition of violence, increasing competition for land and resources, and increased violence? And did Latter-day Saint theology affect how Mormons treated Indians? Marginally. And what differences existed between white Native conflicts, Mormon country and elsewhere? And it kind of goes on a little bit from that. But one of the things that, and I'm going to speak to just a few things in terms of like general themes that I see throughout the book. One thing that I asked myself that is this like a Mormon history that the topic happens to be indigenous people, or is this an indigenous history that intersects in a sense with like Mormon history? How do we read this text as indigenous history? Kind of going back to the question posed and some of Sarah's comments, as I was reading this, I was reminded of a book by my mentor, a Dakota historian, Moise Yatawin. And in her book, Decolonizing the Eli Taylor Narratives, she actually talks about what it looks like to write good American Indian history. One of the things that she talks in her introduction is that, for example, historians who would consider themselves like historians, let's say of like French history, of like Spanish history, right? Like you cannot consider yourself a historian of that particular country, people, etc., if you didn't know the language. And so that's one of the things, right, in terms of looking at, one, the breadth of this volume, because of the diversity of tribal nations, that's one thing where it is difficult, right, to master every indigenous language. But the other thing kind of looks at how do you intersect Mormon and indigenous history, where it centers indigenous voices and perspectives, rather it just being indigenous peoples as the topic of it. And so reading this, and again, it looks at the sources and how we frame as historians the histories that we write. So one, kind of touching on what Sarah mentioned already, is I'm reminded again of some of the work that I see like what by another Dakota scholar, Gwen Westerman, in her book, Minnesota Makoche, she actually talks about how the relationship of a people to its lands, where they live, is crucial to understanding their history and culture. And so by having an understanding, and what I do appreciate in the book is the use of creation stories, because what creation stories do is it helps center Indigenous voices, but it also helps center Indigenous worldviews and perspectives, but more importantly, looking at the relationship to land. So, and you know, identity as Indigenous people, it's not just like a political identity, it's also looking at how we as Indigenous people live our lives, our connection to land, looking at relationships, looking at kinship, etc., and how that dramatically then became, and how that was then affected by Mormons and Mormon settlers. So the other thing then is looking at how can this history, this documentary history, and these documents actually tell us, right, about Indigenous peoples in history. And even the story that Sarah shared earlier, I think, is very important, right, when we're talking about that young woman. Because what we see then is when we talk about gendered violence and looking at violence against Indigenous people, and specifically women, this is the roots of that when we talk about like the 19th century. And more importantly, when we talk about contemporary issues facing tribal nations and peoples, when we look at, for example, missing and murdered Indigenous women, that's not a recent phenomenon, as people like to articulate. It's not the result of criminal jurisdiction issues, right, prosecution, etc., and the interference by the federal government. But in fact, it's rooted in the dehumanization of Indigenous people, specifically looking at women, right? Women as not just disposable, but, right, this idea that Sarah talks about is like the erasure of Indigenous women, and talked about very much in a very like gendered, sexualized manner. Because within that, right, even our job as a historian then is to frame that, right, to frame that this is actually the use of violence, which Ned Black Hawk talks about in his book, right, Violence Over the Land, not just as a use, right, by the colonizer, but actually a methodology and a way to subjugate and oppress a people, and how we can use that as a way to better understand history. The other thing that I also think of is like, again, if we take what's written as kind of like our starting point here, what can we do with the sources? And this is where I think it's important to really understand like Indigenous worldviews and history is, one, and Sarah spoke to this a little bit already, is that within looking at Indigenous history, there is not one history, right? So just as I talk today, I may be Dakota from my community, but I don't represent my entire community because we have two tribes on our reservation, and then we actually have different bands and then different communities who made Fort Peck kind of like this, their homeland, because settlers had displaced them. And as a result, right, like I speak because I am a citizen of my nation, but at the same time, I don't speak on behalf of my entire nation. Let's look at the idea, right, of like creation stories, how we as a people come from the land, right? One thing is that what I see is that when you ask an elder in our community, and let's say you went and you interviewed, you know, like 6-7 different elders, what you'll actually find is that many of their stories are similar, but there's going to be small variances within that. And that's significant because we take all of those stories, right, as fact. There's not one story that's true. There's not one that's more true than the other. There's not just one elder that is the expert, but all of these stories, right, there's something that we can learn from that. The other thing is that like oral traditions, like oral histories, written sources, all of this information is coded in the landscape, right? So all of these pieces of information can be seen as complementary, creating a resonant history in which there are multiple voices, including the eloquent voices of Indigenous people, both past and present. So even looking at some of these chapters, right, when we talk about like the Mormon settlers' encounters with Omaha people or Umaha from their perspective, like, you know, because if you ask Omaha people here, they're not going to, their views of Mormon settlers is very different. And even I have a friend who says, like, they're very proud that they kicked out Mormons. They're like, hey, you're stealing all of our resources. Like, you need to leave. We're done with you. And then the other thing is looking at place names. And there's a couple different books out there that do a really great job about talking about the importance of, again, fusing language, worldviews, right, and stories with the land. And how do these names, right, so even like the example that Sarah gave us earlier of like Timpanogos, like people think that's a very like Utah name, but even Utah itself, right, like why is that the name, these place names that we have, people don't know that those are indigenous. Right, so liken it unto the context that I know of Dakota people. Minnesota, that isn't a Dakota name, but we don't talk about like Minnesota as a Dakota name. And when you center that history, people get really upset, right? When we say, wait a minute, you know, settlers weren't the first ones here. Dakotas have been here much longer. People get really upset when that history kind of challenges their perspectives. The other thing is also to kind of rethink what we, and this goes back to like what I wrote down regarding like sources. How do we read these sources, but also what do we consider sources? Are sources only those that are written? And again, like those written sources, whether it be like by missionaries, whether it be like settlers, whether it be like in journals, who's writing that, whose voice gets privileged? And then that's also related to the archive, right? Like in terms of whose history gets to be preserved. Because even within that, you know, you can still read very much an indigenous history in all of these sources if you know how to read sources, right? And I think that's important, is that this is why it's important to be like in a community where you understand that, because if you understand a community, you can then, like that really good example Sarah gave us earlier of reading, this is what they said, but this is actually what her, like her descendants say. And what you'll see, for example, is then those written stories can be confirmed by the oral tradition if you know how to verify those records. And it's kind of verifying it for Indigenous people, I would say the opposite. Stories that we grew up hearing, so for example, I grew up hearing all these stories about Sioux people, and I was like, who are these Sioux that they're talking about? Because they just categorize all our different people of the Ocheté Chagoin into one. But I was like, no, we're Dakota. I don't understand this. But then to always say that we were the cause of conflict, et cetera, like that wasn't the story that I heard growing up. And so I knew then to challenge those stories as a young person. And I knew that those stories weren't accurate. But I knew that because I'm from my community. I grew up in my community. And so I think also like looking at how do we validate history and whose history gets validated as a result in the written source, but then also looking at archives and how archives are also these spaces which I would say either contribute to like the erasure of Indigenous people. Finally, in terms of thinking about sources, what came to mind reading through this is that people like to think that Indigenous people, we didn't have written records, right? We didn't keep our history, but we did. In the Dakota context, for example, we have written records on what people would consider like winter counts, right? Like on like, for example, buffalo hides, you'll see histories and different things that account for different years and events. The history kind of goes present to the back. And they're called winter counts because we share our histories like during the winter time. There's one person who's charged with that, who becomes kind of the historian, and they go and share like these stories with their communities, visit different Teochpaes or families. And this is how we transmit history. But you wouldn't know like this winter count or like these hides, right, that have these important histories of our community and our people, if you didn't know that those are written sources, but just in a very different way because they're not written in English. The same things in terms of looking at reading the landscape. There's a lot of place names associated, but also even looking at, for example, there's a lot of hieroglyphs, right? Things that are written and etched into the land that tell about migrations, that mark a spot or places as sacred. And this is stuff that we can also include within this larger like historical narrative. Lastly, in terms of just kind of thinking about things, is that looking at terminology, like, and how terminology becomes important when we write histories, because as much as we try, like, and what I teach my students, even as a trained historian, is that All history is subjective, whether we like to believe that or not. As much as we strive to be objective, it's just not possible because of how we are raised, our worldviews, the communities that we come from. So we can consult all the different sources and try to come up with an accurate narrative, but it is still subjective in how we view the world. One thing that, right, like when we talk about violence, et cetera, one thing that's really missing, I think, is in terms of looking at, it's not just the acts of like individuals or leaders like Joseph Smith or Brigham Young, right? These are not actions that happen in a vacuum. These decisions don't happen in a vacuum, but are larger, I would say, like systemic issues in terms of looking at colonialism. And this is where I think it's important to merge like Mormon history and Indigenous history, because there's conversations that are happening in each field that don't happen oftentimes together. And of course, and as a personal plug, like this is what my book is hoping to do, is to bridge, right, like this gap between Mormon and Indigenous history and talk about Mormon settler colonialism in ways that we haven't necessarily had these conversations. But you wouldn't talk about colonialism and how Mormon settlers ultimately not only define what it means to be Indigenous through this construction of a Lamanite identity, but ultimately the idea that the fact that they can move, right, from whether it's Missouri, whether it's from Nauvoo, they move west and they claim land, right? And I know, like, Will, in the beginning, either the introduction or first chapter, we talk about, like, this place, like, maybe the Goshutes, I think, relied on it more than, like, the Utes, but that wasn't really an area in which was like widely used. But I think that also contributes, like that terminology, that perspective also contributes to the erasure of Indigenous people, because Indigenous people were there. It's just that how, again, going back to relationship to land, it's very different. Indigenous people don't stake off lands, right? They don't like fence off land and farm it in the way that was recognizable to settlers as being, you know, useful. And so I think like looking at, again, this is why Indigenous perspectives are important, is because ultimately, whether like the arrival of settlers disrupted, right? And it was disruptive, and not just like looking at claims to land and resources, but it ultimately changed Indigenous people. And this is also part of where I think just in general, like Mormon history has to be placed into this larger context of US history. Right, because even though like Mormons like try to go and escape west because of religious persecution, they still are again extending like U.S. colonialism, right? Because that land wasn't still free for the taking, right? That land had in a sense been owned by Mexico. And then you have all of this other wars and conflicts, and I won't get too much into that. But again, it all goes back to perspective and then how we position and how we write history as historians. And then finally, just because I'm interested in asking, like, hearing the audience questions and whatnot, I think I'm going to end, like, with this one quote, because, like I said, as I was saying, and actually, and one thing I will say is that as I'm working on my manuscript and trying to finish it, this is a really good documentary, like, series. Same thing with, like, the Joseph Smith papers, right? Like, and this is where I think, like, it's important as scholars to ask questions about, like, who has access to that? You know, and who gets access to these resources? You know, was Will given, like, you know, phenomenal access to resources by the LDS archives in ways that I may not have been as, like, an Indigenous scholar? Because then ultimately changes how, what history gets to be written and by whom. And again, it goes back to, like, the idea of who gets to control some of these narratives. And then finally, I think that because all of us have important histories to tell, not just Indigenous peoples, but we have family histories, our community histories. But this is one of my quotes from Waziathuin. And what she states in her her article, from a grandmother to a granddaughter, she's actually talking about the U.S. Dakota War of 1862, in which her great. But what she states is all of us have an obligation to remember our stories so that we may pass on the information to our children in the way the information was originally given through the oral tradition and language of our people. And that all of these stories, right, are not just a simple dissemination of historical fact. They are more importantly transmissions of culture upon which our survival as a people depends. And when our stories dies, so will we. And I think it's important then to remember is that this is an important starting point, but it's also important now then to take that next step is to have not just Indigenous scholars, but scholars of Mormon Indigenous history start to interpret these documents, but also to preserve more Indigenous voices. You know, like, and I'll just give the last example, like my second, and I'll conclude with this. My next book is actually going to be in my own community. And it's interesting because like missionaries, Mormon missionaries arrive, you know, like in the late 1960s, there's like an interesting like vision by this apostle out on the west end of our reservation. But, you know, to tell this history, one of the things I'm challenging is that Mormon history or Mormon Indigenous history doesn't start with the arrival of those Mormon missionaries. And in fact, our history started much earlier. But more importantly, how do Dakota and Assiniboine people make Mormonism their own? And how, for example, my grandmother was one of the first converts in Poplar, one of the first Dakota converts in our community, and my grandfather. But how did they make Mormonism their own? And I talk a little bit about this in my publication, Decolonizing, and Decolonizing, I know this is a place, sorry, and towards a post-colonial Zion, but one of the things I talk about is like when I go back into my community and I go to our branch, it's very different. Like Mormonism does not look the same as my experiences when I lived in Utah. And I think this is important to look at how people tell their own stories and history, because the way we tell our stories is very different than what I see currently considered like Mormon Indian history. So I'll just leave it as that.
Thank you, Dr. Boxer, very much. Thank you, everyone. Sarah, I wanted to apologize. I was trying to give you kind of a 5-minute warning earlier, and I think it came across as I was trying to get you to stop. Was there anything else you
No, I was actually done when that popped up. I was right at the end.
Sorry. Hey, there is a question from the audience, but before we get to that, I wanted to give Will a chance. Dr. Boxer had kind of asked Will about the access he was given and what kind of access did he get from the LDS Church. Could you tell us a little bit about how that worked, Will? Will, you're still muted. There you go.
Oh, thank you. I comment on it in the book and how for years and years, I was denied access to anything but microfilms and had to go into the archives and sit down with the microfilm and transcribe it. And that's all you could do if you wanted to go through the Brigham Young papers. And then years ago, my friend Rick Turley and others opened up, liberated the archives. Marlon Jensen deserves credit too. And not only did they liberate it, I watched them microfilm all these different papers and create images, JPEGs of them. And all those are available to anybody who wants to access them. And they're now in PDF form. And I commented, it did complicate my job because I then had to go back and verify some of the transcripts I had against the manuscripts, which is why it took so long and why my collaborators died off as I worked. But and I need to thank Artis Partial, too, because she did a tremendous transcription job for Floyd O'Neill, one of my mentors and a great Indian scholar. But I was also... I am aware that there are written accounts, and one of the best things I found, which I credit an artist for, was a letter written by Wakara, and there's a picture of it in the book. So there is a record that you won't find anyplace else in Mormon studies. And that's enough of me.
Thank you very much, Will. There is a question from the audience for Sarah and Dr. Boxer. It says, so much of what you have all discussed points to the issue of inherited generational trauma. Can you speak to this issue and how it impacts Native peoples now? Sarah or Dr. Boxer, either of you comment on
that? I have a few thoughts on that. first, it's impacted generations of ancestors, of our grandparents, of our parents, our great-grandparents. And there's this place of respect where we respect what they've gone through and give them space for healing, and however, wherever their paths take them, there's this sense of, at least for me, respecting individual paths to healing, because they went through things that I can't even imagine. As far as how it impacts people now, I always look at how things are impacting children, because I know what I experienced as a child. I know I've heard different things that my cousins have told me, friends have told me that they've gone through, and there's a huge variety. But how do these, more specifically Mormon teachings, impact children development now is what we're going to see on how it impacts Native peoples. And as far as children, they're still growing up. Like in 2019 at the BYU Education Week, there was the teachings about Columbus, and a number of active believing Native Americans started trying to explain, hey, it doesn't say Christopher Columbus in the Book of Mormon. We don't know where the great waters are. It never specified any of this. This is interpretation. And they tried to speak out about the problems with Columbus himself. In response, in this year's 2020 Come Follow Me manual, it specifically states that it's Christopher Columbus that the scriptures are talking about. So now we've labeled where the great waters were. We've labeled people specifically as Lamanites. And we've got this Christopher Columbus narrative going out to young indigenous children again, growing up with the same teachings of colonialism and this one-sided narrative, one-sided interpretation. And that can definitely impact children's development. We also still have in the current seminary manual and in the current Come Follow Me manual teachings that specified the dark skin of the Lamanites were the curse. Now there's the whole discussion of, well, the church has disavowed it, but disavow means to deny responsibility for. They have not denounced it. So it's kind of like, what I try to compare it to is it's kind of like animal sacrifice, how it was had its purpose in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament, we don't need it anymore. So my ancestors were cursed with dark skin because they turned away from God, but my skin's no longer a sign of that. Even though I inherited dark skin from them, it's no longer considered a sign. So it's still current theology, but they're trying to like present it in a way that it seems like they don't believe that anymore. It's still current about my ancestors. Christopher Columbus is still in it. People are still singing Book of Mormon stories where Lamanites are given land only if they live righteously. So the best thing I can say is within Mormonism, at least, these beliefs still impact people dating, people raising their kids, indigenous children, self-identity and sense of self-worth, and their relationship to land, community, God, all of it is still kind of impacted because the Native American interpretations are not included. So I hope that kind of answers the question. Do you have anything, Elise, to add to that?
Well, looking at that, I mean, like, when I always think of, like, intergenerational trauma, there's always a few things that come to mind. First of looking, I think, like, most communities right now are dealing with intergenerational trauma in a variety of different ways, but one I would think is more on, like, the aspect of healing, and healing done through, like, reclamation of language, culture, identity. So I think, like, looking at that, that's one way. Personally, I'll give you a context on how, like, I talk about it, especially with my students. When we talk about intergenerational trauma, there's a few different scholars. There's a Lakota scholar, Maria Brave Horse, Yellowheart Brave Horse. It's a long one, but if you just type intergenerational trauma, she'll come, and Lakota, Maria, she'll come up. She's kind of pioneered that terminology. But one thing you kind of talk about, like, is kind of like this, like a heaviness that you carry, like you inherit this trauma, or like other scholars like Linda Hogan talks about this in the idea of like a soul wound or soul trauma. But I think it's one to name it for what it is, to acknowledge what it is. And then it's really how you deal with that. You know, so I always define it for my students is that this trauma that you inherit. So for example, in the Lakota context, and even the Dakota context of the U.S. Dakota War of 1862, when I talk about our people, like Dakota people, we live in a diaspora, right? Because my people are in Montana. We come from like traditionally like Minnesota, and kind of like the confluence of the rivers. But how is it that then Dakotas end up in Montana, parts of Minnesota, Canada, you know, Nebraska, like Iowa? Like, why are we all apart? And it's because of the U.S. Dakota War of 1862, and we end up, you know, being and living in this diaspora, sometimes disconnected from one another. So one, it's also claiming and using like Dakota language, but like even like kinship, right? Like, where do we fit into this discussion? But also the other thing I talk about with my students, especially in the context of boarding schools, which I think is the most obvious example. My great-grandparents went to boarding school. That's actually where they met, at boarding school, at Carlisle Indian Boarding School. And then my grandmother went to boarding school. And it's interesting because like, my grandma passed away when she was 5, but I still have very vivid memories of her. And again, because of her presence, and I mean, she ran our family. I can say that, like, there's still like the way we lit, what I learned from her. But one of the things, because she also went to boarding school, that she taught my father and his siblings, and then ultimately by extension us, is that whether we like it or not, is that we have to live in the Washichu world. You have to live in this white world. But how do you navigate this space? Because I don't buy into this idea that we live in two worlds. We don't. There's only one world. But how do you maintain your identity as a Dakota person in that context? And what she taught us was that you have to learn their language. You have to learn English. You have to get the credentials, right? The education, because that's the only way that people are going to respect you, right? So for example, like the fact that I have a PhD in history gives me a level of authority that I shouldn't have to have, but I do when I talk about the context of like Mormon Indian history. Having a PhD in history and that being like my, what I'm writing my book about, that gives me a level of authority, right? And this is part of my own personal healing, is that because my grandma went to boarding school, what she did to protect my father was that she didn't teach him our language. She didn't, I mean, and he grew up in a household where there was 4 languages, 3 of which were indigenous. And so why she did that was to protect him. And again, kind of going back to Sarah's point, like, he did that, she did that deliberately, right? Whether, like, I can be like, oh my gosh, my grandma, because I can, when I hear Dakota, I say it speaks to my heart. I may not be fluent, but I love it, and I it's something I'm learning from my boys. But what I think it's important, though, is that she made that to protect us, because that's what our relatives do. That's what our grandparents, our ancestors did. They did what they had to do for us to survive. And so my responsibility, right, is then to pick that up and then to say, what is my responsibility to my children? But also I can heal, right, by learning Dakota, by claiming and learning cultural values and teaching my children that. So the fact that my 3 boys, right, they can say Damakota. They have names that are Dakota names that are named after our male relatives as a way to reclaim a history and a culture that people tried to erase, because those Dakota names there's English translations of those. And I'll give you an example. One of my children, he's named after my grandfather, whose name was Ezra Ricker, my great-great-grandfather. Now that was his English name. His Dakota name was Hehaka Kuchia, which is low elk, or an elk that appears low to the ground. And we gave our oldest that name because it was a way to reclaim and to heal and to bring things in a sense full circle so that my children aren't raised in that. And that's one way, I think, in terms of looking at generational trauma and intergenerational trauma, ways to deal with that and to heal from it. But also that's kind of why we're here too, right, is to make sure that we have a voice, and to also offer up perspectives that sometimes are uncomfortable, that don't fit into this Mormon narrative. You know, because I grew up with those same stories, and like with my children in primary, I'm like, no, not going to happen. Like, and I will do a whole history on this if you want me to, but we're not going to perpetuate this. And so I think that's part of that too, is like being an advocate for my children, and making sure that when they, you know, their safe space is for them. But first and foremost, they're always Dakota, and that's who they will be.
Thank you so much. We do have a couple of more questions here. One asks, what from this book might inform discussions of repatriation of Indigenous artifacts and land? Anybody have a comment on that? Or even if it's not from the book, any comments on repatriation of Indigenous artifacts?
There's a section on the destruction of a piece of Native artwork that was in what was called Red Canyon and is just below Anson Peak. And it apparently was a Ute warrior on a horse and was beautifully executed. And we get this from the son of a man that it's from a guy who grew up among the Indians in early Salt Lake, and it's a loss. It shows the loss of what an incredible heritage Native people had, and how the destruction of not just the people themselves, but their relics was pretty relentless. And I've had a report, I haven't been able to verify it, that Wakara's bones, Wat Walker, have been found in U.S. Possession, and that they will be repatriated to the Ute people. But we can all hope, and we can try to make the injustice we executed less unjust.
I would also like to add, though, in terms of looking at repatriation, those conversations that happen are like with the Native American Graves and Protection Act, that's a federal piece of legislation. And so one of the issues, right, is that unless it's an institution that receives some type of federal funding, right, for I think of like the Smithsonian, for example, or anything that's found on public lands, if it's in private possession, there's no push for repatriation, right, because it's by private ownership, which is where a lot of this, like, I'll call it like grave robbing, right? Like, that's kind of what really literally happened. And I'm reminded of a story a few years ago that happened in southern Utah, where somebody, there was like, in an essence, a raid on their home, and all of these like items, things that were left in graves and whatnot. There were federal charges with that, but it's, I think, an issue in a conversation that unless it's done, like, this is a federal piece of legislation, it would be up to, like, individuals and then private institutions to really assess their collections and then talk with specific tribal communities. And even for individuals who own things privately, I think then it's up to them to also return those items, because a lot of these items are not meant for public consumption, and they were not meant to be held in collections, you know, for this period of time or even much longer.
Thank you very much. Sarah, did you have a comment on this?
Not, no. Elise covered some of what I was going to say with just it being federal, but I don't know enough about, you know, the system and how that would all work. I do know the government would need to be involved in a lot of it, or it would have to be in the private instances. They'd have to want to make amends.
Yeah, and even then, like right now, if you're following any of the repatriation issues, like UC Berkeley, right? Like, they are just digging in their feet and not wanting to do stuff. So it was meant to return a lot of, like, not just like remains, right? But also like different items, but it's really up to the institutions. And then also it puts responsibility on tribal nations to have the funds to prove, because that's the other part of it. You have to prove that these belong to you. And a really great reading, if you're interested, would be by James Wrightingen, who's a Pawnee scholar. And he has a chapter in a book titled For Indigenous Eyes Only that kind of has us to really rethink about NAGPRA and re-envision what that would look like. Because I think if you put in a personal context, how many people would be upset if your ancestors' remains were dug up for scientific examination, or people wanting to understand, you know, what happened, you know, with like pioneers or what, like people would be really upset about that, or stealing different items. So I think if you sometimes you personalize that, it maybe helps people better understand it. But either way, these conversations are always difficult, and the responsibility should not always be on Native peoples and communities to prove that these peoples and items belong. And that they should be returned to their communities.
Thank you very much. I wanted to throw a question to Sarah or Dr. Boxer. Dr. Boxer, you referenced your essay, This is the Place, Disrupting Mormon Settler Colonialism. And with that kind of in mind, Utah, of course, just celebrated its favorite holiday of the year, Pioneer Day. Ladies, could either one of you give us, you know, some insights or thoughts on how do we readdress this Mormon settler colonialism and Pioneer Day and all this and make it more appropriate and friendly for Native people?
I think and this is just from my personal view, like Elise, though I'm Tsimshian or though I'm Indigenous or Native American, it's not like I speak for every Indigenous person out there. This is just my personal view, or how I find healing is being basically half pioneer and half, you know, there's both of these ancestries that I carry. I have this heaviness on both sides of history. And there's beauty in people regardless of ethnicity. One of the best things I did when I was in college was just a few years ago, I added Eastern philosophy to my studies as a minor. And I studied religions and cultures around the world. It was the most enlightening, beautiful, absolutely beautiful experience I had, because I went from having this small world view to having this gorgeous, beautiful view of religions and cultures and beliefs around the world. And at the center of virtually every single one were beliefs of love, beliefs of kindness, beliefs of forgiveness and gentleness, and just that love at the center of so many different cultures, even if there was examples in their history that obviously were war or hardships. There's this desire in humanity to have love so valued at the center, or kindness valued. And so when I look at the pioneer history, you know, there's beautiful people that created this, you know, beautiful environment. I grew up in a time when there was, you know, the road shows and the basketball and, you know, I guess the glory days of this little time in Mormonism. But people are absolutely beautiful. I made so many amazing, wonderful friends. And some of my pioneer ancestors, I loved reading about the courage they had also, just as much as I love my Tsimshian ancestry. So to me, you can't really demolish pioneer values and replace it with Indigenous and expect that to fix everything, because that's not an Indigenous way, at least not in Tsimshian philosophy. But if when Pioneer Day was celebrated, there was this acknowledgement, and part of that acknowledgement was what was done, it would completely change it. And that's just my opinion. I thought about, you know, like Memorial Day is celebrating or remembering those who have given their life. If the Pioneer Day was able to embrace both sides of their history, and not just this one side of, look, we've survived and we got to the land that God gave us. and it also included the Indigenous people who were hurt and traumatized and displaced off of their ancestral lands. My idealistic side tends to get the better of me, and I hope that there'd be a way to unify it, but that's the best I have. Each human interaction, you just have to figure out, you know, the best train of course. But of course, at the top is always people in power. So it doesn't matter what my hopes or idealistic ways are. It's going to be those that control what's going on those that have the power. And I was also going to add with the artifacts and reparation that there's a lot of money involved in that. And so some artifacts are insured for phenomenal amounts. And so, again, it's always those in power. Do they want to continue to control the narrative of Indigenous existence in America, or do they want to embrace it? And as far as being Indigenous on Pioneer Day, I definitely back away from celebrating the pioneers, and I veer more towards similar to Memorial Day and remembering those who passed on. So even if you just make it a personal thing, I don't know. I don't know how else to answer that, but anybody else have anything? Elise?
I guess I'm like the opposite, because it's like part of it, I think,
a question.
And I talk about this in my chapter, and this is also going to be a chapter in my book, because part of this is just that very nature, right? Like pioneer implies, right, like is a very different than the term settler. Like call it settler day, like Mormon settler day, and I would be happier. Like, because then it's acknowledging, right, that you are foreigners, but you try to remake this land as your own. That to me, I think, reads very different. But I think the issue goes back to whose history gets to be told, whose history is centered, because why is this also a state holiday, right? Like, it's, again, contributing and remaking, like, this landscape as Mormon, as if other people weren't there. Even if you look at, like, the parades that happen around that, who gets to have this parade? Like, not just the parade, but, like, enter in, right? So even looking at other marginalized communities, like our LGBTQIA communities, right? Like, they were completely silenced. And forgive me, because I don't remember the name of the group, but they had petitioned to have a float in the parade, and they were completely denied, right? Because it doesn't fit into this narrative of like happy pioneers celebrating this heritage. And so I think that to me is the issue, is because we get to, you know, like there's this presentation, and I've gone to it, like talk about trauma. That's more traumatizing to me than anything. But like when I was gone there, it's just kind of like, we're only going to include people who support this narrative. And Indigenous people, even on that day, either you're supporting that narrative or you guys get to have your own celebration in Liberty Park. You know, it's not central to those actual, you know, the main parade that happens, like, for example, in Salt Lake City. So I think for me, like Pioneer Day, it's like the conversations that were happening, right, throughout our nation. And it's not just in the Mormon context. What do these monuments, these like plaques, these statues tell us about history, and whose history gets to be remembered and whose history gets erased? And this is also where I wish like Darren was here, because I love listening to Darren talk. But even look at the, like the Shoshone massacre, right? Like look at the contestations over place at that site. Whose history gets to be told, and why do the people who were massacred and whose land it was don't even oftentimes get to tell their story? You know, most Mormons don't know that. You know, I went to Utah State and very few people even knew about the Bear River Massacre. So I think part of this has to go back to, like, again, whose history gets to be memorialized and marked? And in that space, right, like, unless you're Mormon, and I know, like, the LDS Church, like, with the sesquicentennial, try to change into everyone's a pioneer, but not everybody is a pioneer. You can't change that, because it's a very much a U.S. context, right? And it's still about erasing other people's, like, perspectives and cultures and identities.
We're over.
Yep. Thank you very much, everybody, so much. We are out of time. I want to thank Will and Dr. Boxer and Sarah for everything they shared today. I want to apologize to CJ for taking over your job.
No, thank you for doing that.
Hey, just a couple things real quick as we get done. If you want a copy of Will's book, The White Swan Everything, I would ask you to try and support local booksellers like Benchmark Books or Ken Sanders' Rare Book. Look him up online and try and get a copy of that. Darren Perry's book, since he wasn't here today, The Bear River Massacre, A Shoshone History. First book written by a member of the Shoshone Nation on the massacre. If you go to the Exhibitors tab on the Whova app, it and all of the By Common Consent books are on sale for 25% off for the rest of Sunstone. I would highly encourage you getting this. I'm going to give him a moment by reading one little quote from the book. He says, "I have decided that many people have a mental snapshot of Native people taken more than 200 years ago. For some reason, they want to retain that image. I have always believed that ancient tribal cultures have important lessons to teach the world, lessons of interconnectedness of all living things, and the fact that our very existence is dependent on the world we seem to be destroying. We are not a thing of the past. We are not extinct. Our languages are still strong. Ceremonies that we've been conducting since the beginning of time are still being held. Our governments are still surviving. And most importantly, we continue to exist as distinct groups in the midst of the most powerful country of the world. But we long to be heard and recognized. We have a culture and a history that our troubled world needs and will instill values and ideals that speak to the heart and soul. Please, please check out Darren's book, as well as Decolonializing Mormonism and Essays on American Indian and Mormon History are both available from the University of Utah Press. Check all those out. Thanks again, everybody, and thank you for being at Sunstone. Bye,
everybody. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all.